regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be
new
changed.
Government regulations, which were created to protect
the regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Good morning and welcome to the Federal Society's fourth branch podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the director of RTP. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the guest speakers on today's call. Today, we're pleased to bring you an interesting and timely discussion on regulatory reforms and the COVID pandemic, featuring three of our RTP working group members. We have joining us Dr. Roger Klein, who is a lawyer and physician on RTP's FDA and Health Working Group. He is a faculty fellow at the Center for Law, Science, and Innovation at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. Also, Shoshana Wiseman, who is on our state and local working group. She is a senior manager for digital media and communications and a fellow at R Street Institute. And also, Dr. David Hyman, who is a lawyer physician and the co-chairman of RTP's FDA and Health Working Group. He is the Scott K. Ginsburg Professor of Law and Policy at Georgetown Law. If our audience would like to learn more about our speakers and their important work, you can visit regproject.org. That's regproject.org, where we have their full bios listed. In a moment, I will turn it over to Roger to get us started. After opening remarks and discussion, we will go to audience Q&A. So please be thinking of all the difficult questions you'd like to ask our speakers. Thank you all for joining us. Roger, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Nate. And so today I want to talk about a really important story that needs to be told, and that involves the clinical laboratory testing that has taken place during the current COVID-19 outbreak. So basically, just as a predicate, clinical laboratory tests are those tests that you use to diagnose or measure what are called analytes. And in this case, we're talking about tests that are used to diagnose the COVID-19 disease or the virus called SARS-CoV-2. So these clinical laboratory tests are performed in a wide range of labs, and these include hospitals, where most laboratory tests are performed, commercial laboratories, both large and small, and including private labs that are owned by, for example, pathology groups. So since 1988, with the enactment of the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments to the Public Health Services Act, clinical laboratories, after issuance of regulations in 1992, have been regulated under the Public Health Services Act, under the auspices of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services through its, quote, CLIA program, or Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments program. It has been an extensive system of oversight that involves state regulation as well as accreditation agencies. And that's for the laboratory testing itself, anything that goes on in the clinical lab. Diagnostic test kits, which are produced by manufacturers and distributed, these include instruments and reagents. Those have, since 1976, been regulated by the Medical Device Amendments to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act. So professionals in laboratories have always set up and validated tests within their laboratories, and they view them as medical services, or in the case of pathologists like me, I'm a pathologist by training, we view that as part of our medical practice. So in 1992, 16 years after enactment of the Medical Device Amendments, FDA first asserted jurisdiction to regulate these tests that are designed, developed, validated, and performed in laboratories, but then mostly claimed to exercise enforcement discretion towards them, taking small moves to assert jurisdiction, but basically keeping a hands-off approach for many years. During the Obama administration, which was encouraging of regulation generally, FDA took significant steps toward regulating laboratory-developed tests, or what we call laboratory-developed procedures, as medical devices under the Medical Device Amendments. The administration went as far as issuing guidance documents that proposed a framework for regulation in 2014. That draft was withdrawn after the November 2016 elections. Laboratory service providers have long resisted FDA oversight. Most tests, molecular tests, for example, have historically been laboratory-developed procedures. I myself have directed a number of labs. Almost everything we did was a laboratory-developed procedure. And we've argued that regulation would impair patient access, slow advancement and innovation, and leave us insufficiently nimble to address changes in technology, medical knowledge, or emergencies like disease outbreaks. During the 2009 through 2010 H1N1 outbreak, laboratories in hospitals and commercial settings rapidly set up tests that helped to meet the exploding clinical demands for testing. This all changed. This paradigm changed in March of 2016 when, during the Zika virus outbreak, FDA sent warning letters to Texas Children's Hospital and another laboratory telling them that they needed to apply for an emergency use authorization. So during the administration, the Obama administration, FDA kind of creeped through some various moves into trying to regulate laboratory-developed tests, and that culminated in that outbreak, the Zika outbreak, where they sent a warning letters to some hospital laboratories, academic laboratories, others, making them apply for or telling them they needed to apply for emergency use authorizations, which are authorized in a public health emergency as a way to expedite medical device use, and FDA allows them on the market under those circumstances. So basically, FDA started regulating laboratory-developed tests in an emergency. So fast forward to COVID-19, and FDA pursued the same policy and through an emergency use authorization on February 5th, the day after a public health emergency was announced or declared by Secretary Azar. The FDA placed CDC in charge of testing and put it in the role of the diagnostics manufacturer, essentially, for the nation. It was the only source of testing, and the testing was to be performed through public health laboratories, which are basically epidemiology labs. So we had government lab testing and government lab test manufacturer as our source of testing in the United States. So and because of faulty design, CDC's kits appear to have experienced contamination. The public health labs were unable to validate them. In addition, there were tight testing criteria. So as of late February, we only had done 472 tests in the United States. But contrast this with the private labs. The University of Washington had a test ready to go. Seattle, the epicenter of the initial outbreak, at least that we knew of, wanted to go live with a test, but FDA wouldn't let them. There were other labs that could have performed testing in New York and maybe would have signaled to us what was going on early. As a result, you ended up having in Seattle initially early on an outbreak in a nursing home that has infected, I don't know, 50 to 100 people and killed probably over 30. So potentially, you know, we could have caught that had University of Washington, which is now performing 3,000 tests a day, been able to go live with its test. On February 29th, FDA issued a guidance document that essentially ingrained the policy allowing them to regulate laboratories, telling them in that guidance that they needed to obtain emergency use authorization. So presented as an expansion or lessening of the what was going on, they had labs could start testing and then had 14 days to file or 15 days to file EUAs. It was in fact a formalization of FDA regulation of laboratory developed tests. I described this in a March 2nd article in City Journal. So by March 16th, the dearth of testing and the problems that we were having. FDA updated guidance to allow states to take responsibility for testing, but I think many labs took this as a signal that few warning letters would go out towards them. Then on March 18th, Senator Rand Paul, who himself has been found positive for the coronavirus, Senator Paul introduced the Verified Innovative Testing in American Laboratories Act of 2020. This act clarifies that clinical laboratories and the tests they develop within them and validate within them are to be regulated under the Public Health Services Act, and even in the cases of emergencies. We not only did we have a problem with the with laboratories being able to quickly set up tests for their patients and manage patients quickly and triage them so that they would know who's positive and who isn't, so that we could allocate resources properly. FDA also hadn't approved any emergency use authorizations for diagnostic kit manufacturers. So test manufacturers who were selling tests in Europe, they were selling these kits in Europe, including some in the United States, didn't have the right to sell them here. So we were hamstrung and had no tests on the market. Dr. David Hyman and I wrote what seems to be perhaps potentially a prescient op-ed in Investors Business Daily in 2017, in which we urged a lessening of the regulatory approach toward manufactured diagnostic tests that are shipped and distributed, while at the same time discouraging FDA from trying to regulate laboratory developed procedures. We see the results of this. The president came in, President Trump, and he put together a public-private partnership. FDA relaxed their rules. We have many laboratories that have jumped in, including LabCorp, Quest, BioReference, and others, and all the many hospitals. LabCorp has publicly announced that they're doing 20,000 tests a day. My understanding is that from published data and conversations is that at a minimum. We did, 67,000 tests yesterday. So we've gone from performing basically no tests to dwarfing any other country in the world, including including countries like Germany and South Korea, which are doing a lot of tests. We were rapidly, by mobilizing the private sector, the private laboratories, we were rapidly able to begin testing many, many patients. And we are, because of it, getting a handle on this outbreak, understanding it, and are much better able to manage it. So with that, I'll close the introductory remarks, but thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Shoshana?
Hi, everyone. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this today. I've been kind of surprised about the extent to which there have been regulatory reforms in response. Roger gave a fantastic overview as it applies to the FDA, but there are even more that I'd worked on in the past and to some extent that I hadn't expected would pop up. One of the biggest ones is allowing medical professionals to work across state lines. There are already certain compacts for a few medical professionals, especially the nurses. That's a pretty widespread compact. But in most cases, professionals of any kind can't easily work across state lines. Last year, Governor Ducey he enacted the first law that allowed professionals to easily transfer in their occupational licenses. And while that's a great idea just for the licensing side of things that enables more mobility, it's really vital now that they have a process that can be expedited. Pennsylvania followed suit soon after. Arizona enacted that with a similar kind of model, not quite as good, but still pretty good. So it's nice that those two states have models to be expedited. It's just too bad that a quarter of the country was moving already to enact similar laws that they hadn't gotten there, just because it would have benefited them to have that kind of model in place. So instead, you see a lot of states waiving laws that stop medical professionals in other states from working in their states. Governor Polis in Colorado did this. Governor Charlie Baker in Massachusetts as well. A bunch of the governors have started this. It just would have been helpful if they had a process to be expedited rather than having to do this on the fly. And this also plays into telehealth because you you have to be licensed in the state you're practicing in. And this applies to telehealth too, even if you're just, you know, looking at a screen. So I think that telehealth is one of these other issues that a lot of, you know, libertarians have been interested in. It's interesting too because, you know, you'll get a lot of criticism from people saying that, what if the medical standards are different, if the standards of practice are different in different states, but they're really not all that different enough to make a difference. And most of these laws take into account good standing anyway. So if people had poor marks on their record or their license was in jeopardy for some other reason, that would factor into whether or not they could become licensed in a new state. And with telehealth too, there's a lot of tools that people haven't been able to take advantage of. Among them is the store and forward system, which is essentially, you know, letting doctors look through people who have logged into the system and asked for medical help. And it allows doctors to prioritize cases. And that's especially helpful now, as with coronavirus, we want to make sure that the most important cases can be prioritized. And part of the other reason that all this matters too is because whether in person or over an internet system, allowing doctors to practice across state lines means allowing them to go where they're needed most. One other factor that plays into this is scope of practice. All that is just letting medical professionals practice everything they know. In a lot of states, nurses can't practice anything unless they're under the supervision of a doctor. They're not allowed to work to the full extent of their knowledge. While states have started to change that law, and actually Ron DeSantis in Florida, the governors there had recently signed legislation that expanded nurse scope of practice, and that was just serendipitous. But hopefully that'll help expand access to care, especially letting nurses take care of cases, maybe taking some of the load off of doctors' backs so doctors can handle the more advanced cases. All that's really important, and all of this, honestly, has been very important before as there's doctor shortages, but the supply of non-physician providers has been increasing. All of this was already important, but especially in the time of coronavirus and medical shortages, this is even more important. A part of this, too, includes not just people who you see in the doctor's office, but pharmacists, allowing them to renew ongoing prescriptions, allowing them to provide over-the-counter birth control, really anything fairly simple like that that allows them to take some of the load off of doctors and reduce doctor burnout is really, really important. Alabama expanded that ability for pharmacists recently in one of many executive orders that states have been putting out recently. And aside from medical things, there's also other regulations that you might not have considered would play a role here, especially with food shortages. And you see all these posts about grocery stores being run out of food. Texas Governor Greg Abbott announced that Texas would waive laws that prohibit alcohol delivery trucks from delivering groceries. So now they can help out, and not only are they able to help out with something very important, and that's food, but hopefully that helps employment as we see a lot of people out of work at this time. Another type of regulation is just restrictions on feeding the hungry. Over the years, there have been so many examples of it's more so local rather than state officials prohibiting people from feeding the homeless and the hungry. You'll hear all different excuses for it, including making sure that they have proper nutrition, but any nutrition is better than none. Last year, there's a really famous case where Must Ministries in Georgia was prevented by the local health department from feeding sandwiches to hungry kids, as they had been doing for quite a long time. So now they have all these extra restrictions on them, and they've been making it work to the best of their abilities. They feed literally thousands of children. But thankfully, the local school department has partnered with Must Ministries to keep that going to kids who are out of school and might not have as easy access to food. There's also regulations that prohibit people from working from home. I'm not even kidding. It applies to people uploading YouTube videos from their apartment at times, people working from home, just sitting at their desk. And a lot of times you need to jump through ridiculous regulations in order to be approved to simply work from home. And while we're asking people to stay inside and we want people to be employed, those regulations really need to be suspended or lifted. And you're not really seeing that happen much, although I suspect that there's going to be a big lack of enforcement. But oddly enough, there's not a lack of enforcement in everything you would expect. Thankfully, some localities and states have suspended parking hour limits, overnight parking rules, things like that, because there's not much traffic to begin with. And again, we want people to stay inside. Although I found out yesterday that Albany has been still enforcing these laws, which isn't helpful to anyone. And it's just more tickets and fines that don't help in the time of coronavirus, which is unfortunate. And my colleague, Nick Zayas, has been working on especially any regulations that apply to transportation. So he's more of the expert on that. But he had come up with some of these ideas, just making sure that people don't have to move their car, really simple things like that. That also plays into DMV restrictions. A lot of those have been lifted, including in Virginia and Colorado, letting people renew their licenses online, closing DMVs and extending the period that licenses are valid for. All those are really good ideas to make sure that people don't have to go outside, go to crowded areas, especially at the DMV when you often find yourself waiting for quite a while. And in addition to these, there's just a lot of long-term solutions. Like I said, with licensing reciprocity, it would have been helpful if more states had enacted that earlier so they would have a process to expedite. And hopefully going forward, they not only enact reciprocity, but also create mechanisms for pandemics, for exactly how they're going to expedite it in times like this. There's also certificate of need laws that, as I think it was Timothy Sandifer has described, as a competitor's veto, it really stops access to medical care. It's frustrating, and a lot of these certificate of need laws are being lifted to make sure that there can be enough hospital beds. It's odd that this wasn't lifted before, although people have explained that this is related to certain Medicaid reimbursement laws. There's even now federal legislation to make sure that states won't be penalized for that. So all this is to say there's no shortage of regulations that need to be scrapped or at least paused in certain cases, like with transportation regulations, to make sure that people are acting safely, they don't go outside, and they have reasonable access to medical care. Thank you.
Thanks, Shoshana. Very interesting. David?
So Roger's given you a nice case study of the FDA regulation of clinical labs, and Shoshana's given you a whole bunch of specific concrete examples of regulatory reforms that people are doing or thinking about. I want to do something a little bit different. I'm going to give you a framework for thinking about the various categories of regulatory reform that you've heard about already, as well as some other things that appear to be on the menu. I teach a course at Georgetown Law titled How to Regulate, and I've written a lot about the regulation of the healthcare system. And so there's a little bit of deja vu all over again for me in talking about this. But let me just give you the framework, sketch it out briefly, because I think it'll help organize the way in which people think about the various reform proposals they're hearing. So the first category, which in lots of ways is the easiest, are things that the proponents want to do because there's a crisis. And they plan for those reforms to go away, and everything will go back to the way it was after the crisis is over. So, you know, we've seen social distancing, closing of non-essential businesses, orders to shelter in place. Nobody's planning to continue those after the pandemic has run its course. We're not going to see, you know, selective closing of specific businesses by government order after the shelter in place requirements are lifted. Shoshana talked about parking restrictions, and she mentioned that many states are closing their DMV or Motor Vehicle Administration. Here in Maryland, they've closed public libraries. And again, those are sort of short-term responses tailored to the kinds of conditions that are likely to spread of COVID. And so that, you know, makes perfect sense. They're not particularly controversial. The second and third categories are more controversial, or certainly should be. And both of them sort of flow from Rahm Emanuel's famous quote about not letting a serious crisis go to waste. So the second category is made up of things that proponents thought were a good idea before the pandemic happened, and they can now push them through because the case for doing so during a pandemic is stronger. And they want to have it sticky. That is, they want it to stay that way after the crisis has run its course because they think it's better policy. So if you're interested in enhancing healthcare system capacity, the list of reforms would include a bunch of the things that Shoshana's already mentioned, occupational licensing reform, broader use of telemedicine, elimination of certificate of need. These are, although she mentioned that libertarians like it, there's actually bipartisan support for some of these things. So the Obama administration in 2015 and 2016 issued a series of reports where they basically said, we think licensing, occupational licensing reform is really important. It's a barrier to entry for lots of people. It makes life much more difficult for people who've had encounters with the criminal justice system. And we ought to be making reforms. The reports actually quote Milton Friedman and Adam Smith. That particular reform has some bipartisan appeal. Issues about how the FDA and the CDC ought to handle approvals and inspections might be specific to the infections that we're facing, but they could also prompt broader revisiting of the balances that are struck by those agencies. And, you know, there have been news reports of things that are being held up from getting to the market because the FDA and NIOSH, which is part of the CDC, haven't been able to cut through the regulatory red tape. So those are the sorts of things that I think are different than the first category, and how sticky in terms of their long-term duration will be remains to be seen. Now, the last category, in some ways, is the most troubling one. These are things that the proponents thought were a good idea before that they can now push through, even though the case for doing so hasn't changed because of the pandemic. They just think it's a good idea, and they want to push it through, and they want it to stay that way thereafter. And we can call this the pure opportunism category. And if you don't like Rahm Emanuel's formulation, Representative James Clyburn was quoted last week as saying, quote, the coronavirus bill is a tremendous opportunity to restructure things to fit our vision. So if you take a look at the bill that's been proposed by the House of Representatives, there's a bunch of stuff, some of which is in the first category, some of which is in the second category, but there are also things about initiatives to encourage board diversity and restrictions on stock buybacks, requiring airlines to buy carbon offsets and the like. That's just a wish list. They had that wish list before the pandemic, and you know, they're basically viewing this as the only train that's leaving town, and they like their bill provisions to be included. It's a bipartisan phenomena. We've seen pushback on AB 5 in California, the bill that basically limits independent contractor status in ways that sweep quite broadly, and concern about it predated the coronavirus epidemic, but it's sort of been amped up. The opponents are saying, this is not just regular level job killing, but even worse job killing in the context of a pandemic. And it isn't just at the federal level. In San Jose, the mayor has decided that gun shops are non-essential businesses, so they have to close. And in Ohio, the attorney general has reportedly ordered abortion clinics to stop performing surgical abortions because they're non-essential surgical procedures. And the equipment that's being used there could be used for essential surgical procedures. Now, there's certainly politically neutral arguments for both of those policies, but does anybody really believe that those arguments were the actual reasons for those policies? If the political valence in each of those locations was flipped, I think we'd see the opposite pattern. Now, there are lots of hard cases that fall in between categories. So the House bill that I've already said some mean things about also provides for voting by mail, which will make a lot of sense if come November we're facing a resurgence of the epidemic. But it also includes same-day registration and routine mailing of absentee ballots, and those had been on the wish list for a while. Now, we've been here before in the midst of the AIDS epidemic. The FDA drew a hard line, and then it beat a tactical retreat after activists occupied the FDA headquarters and press coverage in Congress turned against the agency. But the same can't be said of how the FDA handled Laetril, where it again drew a hard line, which it took to the Supreme Court and won a unanimous judgment vindicating its outright ban. So let me sum up. Our regulatory status quo is the result of imperfect and often anecdotal information about the problem, mixed intentions, both good and bad, path dependence, politics, and a long series of attempts to play regulatory whack-a-mole. against a backdrop of policies and procedures that are deliberately intended to limit administrative discretion. Now, when you combine that with just enough petty bureaucracy and turf protection to make things interesting, you've got a recipe for the kinds of problems we're now facing, including the ones that Roger highlighted at the outset. But the stakes now suddenly seem much higher. So in thinking about the problem of regulatory reform in the midst of pandemic, I think it's useful to remember Chesterton's fence and only tear down regulatory constraints or construct them differently if we've got a good theory as to why somebody else thought the regulation was necessary in the first place, and a better theory and some evidence on why we should replace it with something else. For lots of things like those in my first category, that will be an easy lift. For the second category, and the third category especially, a much harder lift. So we should be asking our usual hard questions about the nature of the market failure, government failure, the decision costs and error costs of a regulatory fix, the public choice aspects of intervention, and the rest of the usual suspects that need to be rounded up. To sum up, don't make things worse, make them better. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. Wanted to go back to Roger to see if you had any additional comments. One thing I had a question about in listening to your presentation was to ask about the FDA's rationale for not opening up testing as you and David had advocated for in 2017. Just sort of give the FDA's perspective and then your further thoughts.
Yeah, thanks, Nate. So David, so in our op-ed, what we argued for was a more rational. At least as I would put it, approach, you know, a more evidence-based approach to regulation based on need, which I think could be extrapolated here. FDA is well-intentioned, in the main, and they're trying to improve public health. And, you know, 2020 hindsight is brilliant. Prospectively, we didn't know we had all these cases, and FDA is saying, well, we want to make sure things work. I think, you know, and then we've had the subsequent explosion of tests, of cases, which we would have picked up, certainly, if people had been testing. But we didn't know they were there. FDA didn't know they were there at the time. But, again, that argues against FDA's policy. But, you know, they would be saying, well, we need to have tests that work. And, people would argue that, well, you've got lots of really good, smart people who are doing testing every day without FDA oversight, and those tests work fine, and we don't have any significant problems with laboratory tests in the United States. So, and when we've got lots of kit manufacturers, and they're selling kits all in Europe, and they sell them for years there before they can sell them here, and they seem to work fine, and you know that. So it's again the balance of protection that the agency would argue versus sort of the practical realities of the day-to-day world.
Yeah, I just add that I think this is the same debate that one always has about what's the right role of the FDA and is it being too cautious or not cautious enough. A former commissioner of the FDA said, most people seem to think we only have two speeds, too fast and too slow. There's never a just right Goldilocks, outcome. And that's a challenge, right? I mean, we don't want bad tests out there. But on the other hand, we don't want to tighten down the valve so much that there are no tests. And as I said in my own remarks, the context of an epidemic focuses the mind and raises the stakes.
Yeah, can I add? I mean, I just want to say the other thing is, I mean, first of all, FDA granted the EUA to CDC, but its test didn't work. So the labs couldn't validate it because it had problems of its own. And it was very low throughput. I mean, you just couldn't do enough. In retrospect, it's very easy, but a system of government-run testing, which isn't what we do anywhere, you know, all of our testing is private, seems to have faltered the same way some would predict.
Very good. Shoshana, any additional points you'd like to make? Or I was curious if there were any of the the regulations that won't be in, that aren't, you know, being relaxed at this point and not enforced during this time, if you have any predictions about which of them that will remain the case beyond this current pandemic, you know, what relaxation of regulations that will just go by the wayside. Any predictions in that regard?
That's a great question, especially because it's always so hard to tell, especially with the patchwork of state regulations we have and different political and regulatory environments. I mean, I'd love to say that a lot of the licensing reforms and a lot of the certificate of need law reforms will stay. I do think you'll see some of them stay, you know, probably codified through the legislature first, as they should be. But I think one of the big highlights we're really seeing now is there was already some recognition of licensing reform and the role it plays in helping people climb up the economic ladder by giving them more opportunity, but especially by expanding access to care. Over the past couple of years, that's one side of the issue I've become really interested in, because so many licensing regulations do stop people from getting care when it just, you know, without other benefits. It's not about safety, it's about where the doctor is located, things like that, or even, you know, not letting nurses do everything they're qualified to do and maybe taking some pressure off of doctors and lowering costs. So I think this will provide a good case study that might help going forward. In particular, though, I think certificate of need laws have become a real center of attention in a way they haven't been before. You know, they're scholars and people like me nerding over this issue, but it's become really widespread where people are noticing why were these laws in place in the first place? Why were we limiting access to care? What was the purpose? And if we're lifting it in times like this, maybe we don't need them to begin with. So I think that you're going to see some of these stay. I don't know exactly how many, you know, and by stay, I mean either the executive order kind of stays or the legislature codifies it formally. And I hope that there's going to be more moves going forward to prepare for future pandemics. Of course, no one wants that. But as this situation shows, it's a reality. As with parking regulations and other temporary suspensions, I don't think you'll see those stay, but you might see some localities putting plans into place, or maybe even think tanks putting out papers on here's how you do it when it comes time for, and this stuff happens. Here's which ones you suspend. Here's which ones you should consider getting rid of to start with, or other laws that might be helpful. So I'm hoping that this helps people plan for the future. And I do think you'll see some of these stay, but just how many is going to determine on how all of this ends up if the regulatory reforms prove helpful, and I think they will.
Let me just add, I think, as Shoshana and her colleagues have written, the occupational licensing problems and scope of practice issues stretch well beyond the healthcare system. And, you know, there are examples involving licensing of interior designers and overly restrictive requirements involving hair braiders and barbers and cosmeticians and so on. And none of those are obviously in play in the context of the pandemic, at least not as a first order consideration. And so I would not expect changes that are the result of the pandemic for the healthcare scope of practice and licensing issues, telemedicine and the like, to spread more broadly. It's possible they can create, you know, a factual case as to why we should be revisiting those things, but they're not going to be teed up initially, and so I'm less confident that those changes, even though I think they'd be quite desirable, are likely to result. I think, like Shoshana, the parking restrictions are going to go back in place, right? They're reasons for having them, and that it's a major source of revenue for lots of places. So eventually you're going to have to start paying your parking meters again.
I'll agree with all of that. And one other point I'd like to add, too, is the low-hanging fruit, like Louisiana having an occupational license for florists, the interior designers, hair braiders, stuff like that. States have already begun reforming those. It's actually kind of, I think states have lagged in some of the more advanced cases, the cases where it deals with medicine and people are a little nervous to deregulate at all for fear of either being called, you know, of basically being called out and saying that they're being driven by ideology rather than facts. But facts do support deregulation, at least in my opinion, and the facts I've seen of these professions. And this, it's interesting because this will really, this will add to the licensing reform movement, the common sense one driven by facts, in a way that that I think it's been lacking before. You've had bipartisan support, especially for the low-hanging fruit before, and even for the middle level and some of the medical things. But I think that this is really going to add to that in a way that will be beneficial, not just to licensing reformers generally, but hopefully to the people affected by these regulations.
Yeah, I agree with that. I just point out nobody's calling for deregulation of the legal profession, which would be valuable to ordinary consumers in terms of getting them access to all sorts of benefits, including low-cost wills, to the extent people are concerned about that in the context of a pandemic.
Roger, are there some additional thoughts you'd like to offer at this point?
Well, I could talk about this all day because I think it's such a critical issue. You know, testing is so important to resolving medical issues. You know, you can't fight what you can't see, and testing is really our eyes. And so we're kind of swinging blindly in the dark. And you can't help but wonder if in New York or in certainly in Washington, where I know for sure they were ready to go, if they had started testing in early February, perhaps we wouldn't be where we are today. So I think, you know, I think that we need to look at regulation, and David has put forth a really great discussion of the balances that you try to strike. But I think what becomes problematic or troublesome is it's very difficult to quantify what you prevent. I think the laboratory issue right now is a rare example where the harms of overregulation, at least in my view, are quite visible. And I think that's something that often is missed from the discussion. You know, you can have regulation is a very, very heavy tool in many instances, and there's certainly a need for it, and it's important. But it needs to be tailored and done right. And I think often, you know, and Shoshana can chime in on this, and David too. But I think often what happens is there's an inherent bias toward risk averseness because it's very hard to see the problems that you cause. What wouldn't have come on the market, what wouldn't have happened, versus arguments about what you've prevented.
Yeah, sorry, Shoshana, go ahead.
Oh, no, you're fine. You can go.
So I was just going to say, yeah, anybody who's done any work with the FDA has seen these basic dynamics, which are, you know, in the sort of inside buzz, you would call these error costs, right? False positives and false negatives. Taking action when you shouldn't have and failing to take action when you should have. Now, in the long history of the FDA, there are multiple instances of the commissioner being called before congressional oversight committees and just hammered for having a drug approved that turns out to have caused, you know, tremendous harms. And, you know, we can debate whether they had good enough information or not. But there are almost no examples of them being called to action in nearly the same way or nearly the same frequency for their failure to approve drugs that, you know, they should have approved more quickly. There are certainly, you know, occasional instances where they're asked questions, why has this drug been approved elsewhere? Why isn't it available to Americans? But the default mode, if you have any sense of self-preservation, or you're trying to avoid criticism, is to be careful because you get criticized much more harshly for false positives, that is approving a drug that you shouldn't have, than for false negatives, not approving a drug that in retrospect you should have. And as Roger pointed out, you know, the retroscope is always 2020 or even 2010. Right after the fact, we all look much smarter than we did at the time.
I totally agree with all that, and you see that same regulatory dynamic on the state level. No matter the state, it's very much the same thing, especially because, especially with licensing regulations and also certificate of need laws, really any of these regulations, you don't get to see the fallout as clearly of what didn't happen because X thing wasn't allowed. For example, with Louisiana florist license, you know, you don't get to see all the florists that aren't allowed to be florists and are doing something else or not doing anything because of it. You have certain anecdotes, and there are ways of quantifying, but they're imperfect because you're trying to model what happened or what would have happened. And particularly with certificate of need laws, part of the reason I was saying too that it should have these laws should have been reformed a long time ago is because there's economic and medical activity that isn't happening because of these laws. There are things you can't see. You can compare state to state, and in certain cases, you'll really be able to get a good picture that way. But for example, one of the Institute for Justice's clients, I don't want to get it wrong, but I want to say that he wanted to open an MRI clinic and provide essentially discount MRIs, and he wasn't allowed to do so due to certificate of need laws. So we don't get to see that happening, let alone the people who weren't Institute for Justice's clients, the people who we don't hear about. I have so many anecdotes, as this applies to all kinds of professions, but anecdotes aren't data. And while there are efforts to quantify that data to paint a fuller picture, they're always going to be imperfect, and partially because of that uncertainty and partially because of the very scholarly nature of the work, your ordinary person isn't going to see that. But if a licensing law is removed or something of that nature, and harm is caused, everyone's going to see that. It's going to be a big story, and there's going to be the proverbial guy in the movie yelling, "There ought to be a law."
Very good. We have our first audience question of the day. Let's go to that question now. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt. Please state your name and affiliation and ask your question. If you'd like to join the queue for questions, please enter star, then the pound sign.
My name is Tom Hayhurst. I'm out in Fort Collins, Colorado, and I'm an independent consultant with the biotech industry. And I have a question, as I'm curious as to why we're not hearing a greater differentiation in the demographics of the people that are infected by this virus. In the beginning, we heard an awful lot about in excess of 60, 65 years old, and then there was some talk about lung problems and immune-suppressed patients. Why are we not getting a greater demographics of the people that are most vulnerable so that we can tailor our activities more towards the most vulnerable rather than the entire population? That's all I have to ask.
Roger, you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, sure. So I think we are, you know, Tom, thank you very much for your question. I think it's clear. First of all, anybody can get infected with this. It's clear, you know, it's obvious that anybody can get infected, and quite frankly, anybody can get seriously sick. But it is most lethal and certainly most toxic to elderly and immunocompromised individuals. I think, and I don't think there's any that's entirely clear. What you've heard recently are some statements, actually based on pretty scant data, but describing impacts on younger people. And there's no question younger people can be seriously affected. I think what that was more a response to the imagery of youth partying on Florida beaches during spring break and not engaging in social distancing, and the fear that young people are going to ignore these warnings because they think that they're not at risk and they're going to spread the virus to older people. So I'd say, you know, I think that's why you heard some of that blurring. The other thing I want to make clear is our data are very limited, and our testing has been done on sick people. I mean, it's prioritized to people who are the sickest, and then tiered down from there. So what we have is what's called ascertainment bias. We are looking at the sickest people. We're probably not capturing many, many infections. For example, if in New York they say they have 23,000 cases, they may have 100,000 or more infections easily. And I look at that based on their laboratory positivity rates. But what that does say is that for most people, this is probably a benign disease. That is infrequently serious and rarely fatal. We don't have those numbers yet. We will learn them as more serology tests come online and we get a better epidemiologic perspective of this disease rather than a biased medical perspective based on testing of hospital patients and others who are heavily symptomatic.
So I agree completely with that. The only thing I'd add, hearkening everybody back to grade school math, is it's useful to think about this in terms of the numerator and the denominator, right? The denominator is the number of people that have the disease, but we've got at best an imperfect measure of that because we haven't done enough testing, and lots of people that, you know, appear to be asymptomatic may in fact have the disease. And so that's going to complicate matters. And then the numerator, if we're focusing on hospitalized patients, are going to give us a somewhat deceptive view of the mortality risks.
Yeah, I mean, Dave is right. So we'll capture the deaths and we'll capture the more serious cases, but what we aren't capturing fully are the non-serious cases. And that's going on anywhere in the world. There isn't a single country where you have close to 1% of the people infected, including or reported as infected, including in China. But what we're seeing in New York, for example, is that may be very, you know, at least certainly in high population density areas, that may not at all be the case, and there may be many, many times the number of asymptomatic infections. That increases the denominator, as David says, and makes the death rate plummet, and we may not be any different than, this might be another H1N1, for example. We don't know that yet, but as we see more people tested, what we're doing now is medical testing. We need surveillance testing now. We have enough data and we know there are enough cases. We need to do surveillance testing, which means testing of unselected populations. We can use serology, which are blood draws for that, and get a much better handle on how pervasive this infection really is.
Roger, this is Nate. And do you have an idea for how long that's going to take for us to have a better grasp of how this compares to prior, for instance, H1N1 or other epidemics?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think sooner rather than later. See, that's what the miracle and the greatness of the United States private sector, especially in laboratory testing. So we have I just across my screen an EUA for a serology test passed in front of my eyes, and I'm told that large commercial labs, which can really do amazing numbers of high throughput testing, will be online with serology tests again, which don't require sticking a swab deep into somebody's nasal pharynx and a PCR test to find whether somebody's infected, but rather look at exposure. You know, whether somebody has developed antibodies, which are defense molecules, whether they've been exposed, and I think we can get these numbers if this is done properly, we should be able to get these numbers pretty readily. We can then get a much better handle on the epidemic, the regions, where do we have to worry? I mean, Washington State, for example, is behaving very differently than New York, probably because of population density, and they're not seeing anything like the explosive numbers, and they've been testing. You know, University of Washington, the smaller state, University of Washington, was one of the early testing sites once they were allowed to test. They're up to, I believe, 3,000 a day. There'll be more soon. But, we're not seeing what we're seeing in New York and Washington, so we need to really do these types of studies.
We have one more question. Let's see if we can get it in.
Good afternoon. This is Jeff Wood from Washington, D.C. I'm just curious how HIPAA as a regulation fits into this in terms of the constraints on sharing relevant epidemiological information. I'm old enough to remember an era in which health information was not as protected as it is today, and I'm interested in speaker's thoughts on that.
I'm not a fan of HIPAA for any number of reasons. I've written about it. But, you know, to the extent the information that's being obtained is obtained in the context of a public health initiative, a different set of rules apply than if it's, you know, provided in the context of a, you know, treatment relationship. And so I think, you know, there's reporting for infectious diseases that effectively trumps the HIPAA requirements that would otherwise require confidentiality. So there's any number of reasons why you should have questions about HIPAA and the way it's been implemented. But I don't think this is probably near the top of the list of reasons to be concerned or critical about HIPAA. Roger, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with David, but I would say that on a practical level, you know, especially in managing individual patients, families, and you know, trying to isolate people who are infected and quarantine people who are exposed. You know, I think there could be some issues, and I also think it not so much the less legal than practical. You know, we're so conditioned to be ultra cautious with any sort of sharing and of information, and people don't, if doctors aren't lawyers and they're not studying HIPAA, everybody gets HIPAA training, but most of that urges extreme caution, and I think there's always a wariness of can you do this, can you do that, and I think at the margins there's probably some potential concern, but as David suggests, I don't think that's at the center of what we're dealing with right now.
My experience, for what it's worth, is that healthcare providers mention HIPAA when they don't want to do something for any number of reasons, and it's just more convenient to mention HIPAA. And some of that, I think, has to do with the sort of risk aversion that HIPAA training encourages. So, you know, there are reasons for changing HIPAA. This isn't near the top of the list.
Very good. Shoshana, would you like to offer our audience any concluding remarks before we hang up?
Sure. No, I really appreciate the opportunity to do this. And I know that at my organization, the R Street Institute, we're always looking for more ways to help, especially as it comes to coronavirus. But, you know, as dire as a time this is, I think we're going to see a lot of opportunity to reform government in ways that can help people, especially as it comes to medical care. So, you know, while this isn't a great time, I am excited to see how things open up going forward. And maybe, you know, maybe there's more opportunities that I haven't come across to open up access to medical care and make sure that people with coronavirus or are prioritized and other people are able to access care.
Excellent. David, Roger, any further thoughts you'd like to give our audience?
Regulation is a policy perennial. We'll be back.
Second that. I mean, look, at the Regulatory Transparency Project, this is what we're trying to do. We're looking at regulations. We're saying what makes sense, what doesn't, trying to start a discussion of how to best protect society, protect people, while encouraging and fostering innovation. And I think it's an ongoing discussion. It's not going to stop.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, and we are grateful to Roger, Shoshana, and David for your great insights today. We, of course, welcome listener feedback via email at rtp@regproject.org. Thank you all for joining us.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. Catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.